Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices. All in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice bone-in tender ribeye steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5. Then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today. Or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Book 2, Chapter 11 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 11, Between Two Banks. By 8 in the evening, the country, as the state of the sky had foretold, was enveloped in complete darkness. The moon, being new, had not yet risen. From the middle of the river the banks were invisible. The cliffs were confounded with the heavy, low-hanging clouds. At intervals a puff of wind came from the east, but it soon died away in the narrow valley of the Angara. The darkness could not fail to favor in a considerable degree the plans of the fugitives. Indeed, although the Tartar outposts must have been drawn up on both banks, the raft had a good chance of passing unperceived. It was not likely either that the besiegers would have barred the river above Irkutsk, since they knew that the Russians could not expect any help from the south of the province. Besides this, before long nature would herself establish a barrier by cementing with frost the blocks of ice accumulated between the two banks. Perfect silence now reigned on board the raft. The voices of the pilgrims were no longer heard. They still prayed, but their prayer was but a murmur, which could not reach as far as either bank. The fugitives lay flat on the platform, so that the raft was scarcely above the level of the water. The old boatman crouched down forward among his men, solely occupied in keeping off the ice blocks, a maneuver which was performed without noise. The drifting of the ice was a favorable circumstance so long as it did not offer an insurmountable obstacle to the passage of the raft. If that object had been alone on the water, it would have run a risk of being seen even in the darkness, but as it was confounded with these moving masses of all shapes and sizes, and the tumult caused by the crashing of the blocks against each other concealed likewise any suspicious noises. There was a sharp frost. The fugitives suffered cruelly, having no other shelter than a few branches of birch. They cowered down together, endeavoring to keep each other warm, the temperature being now 10 degrees below freezing point. The wind, though slight, having passed over the snow-clad mountains of the east, pierced them through and through. Michael and Nadia, lying in the after part of the raft, bore this increase of suffering without complaint. Jolivet and Blount, placed near them, stood these first assaults of the Siberian winter as well as they could. No one now spoke, even in a low voice. Their situation entirely absorbed them. At any moment an incident might occur, which they could not escape unscathed. For a man who hoped soon to accomplish his mission, Michael was singularly calm. Even in the gravest conjunctures, his energy had never abandoned him. He already saw the moment when he would be at last allowed to think of his mother, of Nadia, of himself. He now only dreaded one final unhappy chance. This was that the raft might be completely barred by ice before reaching Irkutsk. He thought but of this, determined beforehand, if necessary, to attempt some bold stroke. Restored by a few hours' rest, Nadia had regained the physical energy which misery had sometimes overcome, although without ever having shaken her moral energy. She thought, too, that if Michael had to make any fresh effort to attain his end, she must be there to guide him. But in proportion as she drew nearer to Irkutsk, the image of her father rose more and more clearly before her mind. She saw him in the invested town, far from those he loved, but, as she never doubted, struggling against the invaders with all the spirit of his patriotism. In a few hours, if heaven favored them, she would be in his arms, giving him her mother's last words, and nothing should ever separate them again. If the term of Vasily Fedor's exile should never come to an end, his daughter would remain exiled with him. Then, by a natural transition, she came back to him who would have enabled her to see her father once more, to that generous companion, that brother, who, the Tartars driven back, would retake the road to Moscow, whom she would perhaps never meet again. As to Alcide Jolivet and Harry Blount, they had one and the same thought, which was, that the situation was extremely dramatic, and that, well worked up, it would furnish a most deeply interesting article. The Englishman thought of the readers of the Daily Telegraph, and the Frenchman of those of his cousin Madeleine. At heart, both were not without feeling some emotion.
"Well, so much the better," thought Alcide Jolivet. "To move others, one must be moved oneself. I believe there is some celebrated verse on this subject, but hang me if I can recollect it."
And with his well-practiced eyes he endeavored to pierce the gloom of the river. Every now and then a burst of light dispelling the darkness for a time exhibited the banks under some fantastic aspect, either a forest on fire or a still-burning village. The Angara was occasionally illuminated from one bank to the other. The blocks of ice formed so many mirrors, which, reflecting the flames on every point and in every color, were whirled along by the caprice of the current. The raft passed unperceived in the midst of these floating masses. The danger was not at these points. But a peril of another nature menaced the fugitives, one that they could not foresee, and above all, one that they could not avoid. Chance discovered it to Alcide Jolivet in this way. Lying at the right side of the raft, he let his hand hang over into the water. Suddenly he was surprised by the impression made on it by the current. It seemed to be of a slimy consistency, as if it had been made of mineral oil. Alcide, aiding his touch by his sense of smell, could not be mistaken. It was really a layer of liquid naphtha floating on the surface of the river. Was the raft really floating on this substance, which is in the highest degree combustible? Where had this naphtha come from? Was it a natural phenomenon taking place on the surface of the Angara, or was it to serve as an engine of destruction put in motion by the Tartars? Did they intend to carry conflagration into Irkutsk? Such were the questions which Alcide asked himself, but he thought it best to make this incident known only to Harry Blount, and they both agreed in not alarming their companions by revealing to them this new danger. It is known that the soil of Central Asia is like a sponge impregnated with liquid hydrogen. At the port of Baku, on the Persian frontier, on the Caspian Sea, in Asia Minor, in China, on the Yunkiang, in the Burman Empire, springs of mineral oil rise in thousands to the surface of the ground. It is an oil country, similar to the one which bears this name in North America. During certain religious festivals, principally at the port of Baku, the natives, who are fire worshippers, throw liquid naphtha on the surface of the sea, which buoys it up, its density being inferior to that of water. Then at nightfall, when a layer of mineral oil is thus spread over the Caspian, they light it, and exhibit the matchless spectacle of an ocean of fire undulating and breaking into waves under the breeze. But what is only a sign of rejoicing at Baku might prove a fearful disaster on the waters of the Angara. Whether it was set on fire by malevolence or imprudence, in the twinkling of an eye a conflagration might spread beyond Irkutsk. On board the raft no imprudence was to be feared, but everything was to be dreaded from the conflagrations on both banks of the Angara, for should a lighted straw or even a spark blow into the water, it would inevitably set the whole current of naphtha in a blaze. The apprehensions of Jolivet and Blount may be better understood than described. Would it not be prudent, in the face of this new danger, to land on one of the banks and wait there?
"At any rate," said Alcide, "whatever the danger may be, I know someone who will not land."
He alluded to Michael Strogoff. In the meantime, on glided the raft among the masses of ice which were gradually getting closer and closer together. Up till then no Tartar detachment had been seen, which showed that the raft was not abreast of the outposts. At about 10 o'clock, however, Harry Blount caught sight of a number of black objects moving on the ice blocks. Springing from one to the other, they rapidly approached. "Tartars," he thought, and creeping up to the old boatman, he pointed out to him the suspicious objects. The old man looked attentively.
"They are only wolves," said he. "I like them better than Tartars, but we must defend ourselves, and without noise."
The fugitives would indeed have to defend themselves against these ferocious beasts, whom hunger and cold had sent roaming through the province. They had smelt out the raft, and would soon attack it. The fugitives must struggle without using firearms, for they could not now be far from the Tartar posts. The women and children were collected in the middle of the raft, and the men, some armed with poles, others with their knives, stood prepared to repulse their assailants. They did not make a sound, but the howls of the wolves filled the air. Michael did not wish to remain inactive. He lay down at the side attacked by the savage pack. He drew his knife, and every time that a wolf passed within his reach, his hand found out the way to plunge his weapon into its throat. Neither were Jolivet and Blount idle, but fought bravely with the brutes. Their companions gallantly seconded them. The battle was carried on in silence, although many of the fugitives received severe bites. The struggle did not appear as if it would soon terminate. The pack was being continually reinforced from the right bank of the Angara.
"This will never be finished," said Alcide, brandishing his dagger, red with blood.
In fact, half an hour after the commencement of the attack, the wolves were still coming in hundreds across the ice. The exhausted fugitives were getting weaker. The fight was going on against them. At that moment, a group of 10 huge wolves, raging with hunger, their eyes glowing in the darkness like red coals, sprang onto the raft. Jolivet and his companion threw themselves into the midst of the fierce beasts, and Michael was finding his way towards them when a sudden change took place. In a few moments the wolves had deserted not only the raft, but also the ice on the river. All the black bodies dispersed, and it was soon certain that they had in all haste regained the shore. Wolves, like other beasts of prey, require darkness for their proceedings, and at that moment a bright light illuminated the entire river. It was the blaze of an immense fire. The whole of the small town of Pushkovsk was burning. The Tartars were indeed there, finishing their work. From this point they occupied both banks beyond Irkutsk. The fugitives had by this time reached the dangerous part of their voyage, and they were still 20 miles from the capital. It was now 11:30. The raft continued to glide on amongst the ice, with which it was quite mingled, but gleams of light sometimes fell upon it. The fugitives stretched on the platform did not permit themselves to make a movement by which they might be betrayed. The conflagration was going on with frightful rapidity. The houses, built of fir wood, blazed like torches, 150 flaming at once. With the crackling of the fire was mingled the yells of the Tartars. The old boatman, getting a foothold on a near piece of ice, managed to shove the raft towards the right bank, by doing which a distance of from 300 to 400 feet divided it from the flames of Pushkovsk. Nevertheless, the fugitives, lighted every now and then by the glare, would have been undoubtedly perceived, had not the incendiaries been too much occupied in their work of destruction. It may be imagined what were the apprehensions of Jolivet and Blount when they thought of the combustible liquid on which the raft floated. Sparks flew in millions from the houses, which resembled so many glowing furnaces. They rose among the volumes of smoke to a height of 500 or 600 feet. On the right bank, the trees and cliffs exposed to the fire looked as if they likewise were burning. A spark falling on the surface of the Angara would be sufficient to spread the flames along the current, and to carry disaster from one bank to the other. The result of this would be in a short time the destruction of the raft and of all those which it carried. But, happily, the breeze did not blow from that side. It came from the east and drove the flames towards the left. It was just possible that the fugitives would escape this danger. The blazing town was at last passed. Little by little the glare grew dimmer, the crackling became fainter, and the flames at last disappeared behind the high cliffs, which arose at an abrupt turn of the river. By this time it was nearly midnight. The deep gloom again threw its protecting shadows over the raft. The Tartars were there, going to and fro near the river. They could not be seen, but they could be heard. The fires of the outposts burned brightly. In the meantime it had become necessary to steer more carefully among the blocks of ice. The old boatmen stood up, and the mujiks resumed their poles. They had plenty of work, the management of the raft becoming more and more difficult as the river was further obstructed. Michael had crept forward, Jolivet followed. Both listened to what the old boatman and his men were saying.
"Look out on the right! There are blocks drifting on to us on the left!
Fend! Fend off with your boat hook! Before an hour is past we shall be stopped!" "If it is God's will," answered the old man, "against his will there is nothing to be done."
"You hear them," said Alcide.
"Yes," replied Michael, "but God is with us."
The situation became more and more serious. Should the raft be stopped, not only would the fugitives not reach Irkutsk, but they would be obliged to leave their floating platform, for it would be very soon smashed to pieces in the ice. The osier ropes would break, the fir trunks torn asunder would drift under the hard crust, and the unhappy people would have no refuge but the ice blocks themselves. Then, when day came, they would be seen by the Tartars and massacred without mercy. Michael returned to the spot where Nadia was waiting for him. He approached the girl, took her hand, and put to her the invariable question,
"Nadia, are you ready?"
To which she replied as usual, "I am ready."
For a few versts more the raft continued to drift amongst the floating ice. Should the river narrow, it would soon form an impassable barrier. Already they seemed to drift slower. Every moment they encountered severe shocks or were compelled to make detours, now to avoid running foul of a block, there to enter a channel, of which it was necessary to take advantage. At length the stoppages became still more alarming. There were only a few more hours of night. Could the fugitives not reach Irkutsk by 5 o'clock in the morning, they must lose all hope of ever getting there at all. At 1:30, notwithstanding all efforts, the raft came up against a thick barrier and stuck fast. The ice, which was drifting down behind it, pressed it still closer, and kept it motionless, as though it had been stranded. At this spot the Angara narrowed, it being half its usual breadth. This was the cause of the accumulation of ice, which became gradually soldered together, under the double influence of the increased pressure and of the cold. 500 feet beyond, the river widened again, and the blocks, gradually detaching themselves from the flow, continued to drift towards Irkutsk. It was probable that had the banks not narrowed, the barrier would not have formed. But the misfortune was irreparable, and the fugitives must give up all hope of attaining their object. Had they possessed the tools usually employed by whalers to cut channels through the ice fields, had they been able to get through to where the river widened, they might have been saved, but they had nothing which could make the least incision in the ice, hard as granite in the excessive frost. What were they to do? At that moment several shots on the right bank startled the unhappy fugitives. A shower of balls fell on the raft. The devoted passengers had been seen. Immediately afterwards shots were heard fired from the left bank. The fugitives, taken between two fires, became the mark of the Tartar sharpshooters. Several were wounded, although in the darkness it was only by chance that they were hit.
"Come, Nadia," whispered Michael in the girl's ear.
Without making a single remark, ready for anything, Nadia took Michael's hand.
"We must cross the barrier," he said in a low tone. "Guide me, but let no one see us leave the raft."
Nadia obeyed. Michael and she glided rapidly over the floe in the obscurity, only broken now and again by the flashes from the muskets. Nadia crept along in front of Michael. The shot fell around them like a tempest of hail and pattered on the ice. Their hands were soon covered with blood from the sharp and rugged ice over which they clambered, but still on they went. In 10 minutes the other side of the barrier was reached. There the waters of the Angara again flowed freely. Several pieces of ice, detached gradually from the flow, were swept along in the current down towards the town. Nadia guessed what Michael wished to attempt. One of the blocks was only held on by a narrow strip.
"Come," said Nadia,
and the two crouched on the piece of ice, which their weight detached from the flow. It began to drift. The river widened. The way was open. Michael and Nadia heard the shots, the cries of distress, the yells of the Tartars. Then, little by little, the sounds of agony and of ferocious joy grew faint in the distance.
"Our poor companions," murmured Nadia.
For 30 minutes the current hurried along the block of ice which bore Michael and Nadia. They feared every moment that it would give way beneath them. Swept along in the middle of the current, it was unnecessary to give it an oblique direction until they drew near the quays of Irkutsk. Michael, his teeth tight set, his ear on the strain, did not utter a word. Never had he been so near his object. He felt that he was about to attain it. Towards 2 in the morning a double row of lights glittered on the dark horizon in which were confounded the two banks of the Angara. On the right hand were the lights of Irkutsk, on the left the fires of the Tartar camp. Michael Strogoff was not more than half a verst from the town. "At last," he murmured. But suddenly Nadia uttered a cry. At the cry Michael stood up on the ice, which was wavering. His hand was extended up the Angara. His face, on which a bluish light cast a peculiar hue, became almost fearful to look at, and then, as if his eyes had been opened to the bright blaze spreading across the river, "Ah!" he exclaimed, "then heaven itself is against us!" End of Book 2, Chapter 11. Book 2, Chapter 12 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 12. Irkutsk. Irkutsk, the capital of eastern Siberia, is a populous town, containing in ordinary times 30,000 inhabitants. On the right side of the Angara rises a hill, on which are built numerous churches, a lofty cathedral, and dwellings disposed in picturesque disorder. Seen at a distance, from the top of the mountain which rises at about 20 versts off along the Siberian high road, this town, with its cupolas, its bell towers, its steeples slender as minarets, its domes like pot-bellied Chinese jars, presents something of an oriental aspect, but this similarity vanishes as the traveler enters. The town, half Byzantine, half Chinese, becomes European as soon as he sees its macadamized roads, bordered with pavements, traversed by canals, planted with gigantic birches, its houses of brick and wood, some of which have several stories, the numerous equipages which drive along, not only tarantasses but broughams and coaches, lastly, its numerous inhabitants far advanced in civilization, to whom the latest Paris fashions are not unknown. Being the refuge for all the Siberians of the province, Irkutsk was at this time very full. Stores of every kind had been collected in abundance. Irkutsk is the emporium of the innumerable kinds of merchandise which are exchanged between China, Central Asia, and Europe. The authorities had therefore no fear with regard to admitting the peasants of the valley of the Angara, and leaving a desert between the invaders and the town. Irkutsk is the residence of the governor-general of eastern Siberia. Below him acts a civil governor, in whose hands is the administration of the province, a head of police who has much to do in a town where exiles abound, and lastly a mayor, chief of the merchants, and a person of some importance, from his immense fortune and the influence which he exercises over the people. The garrison of Irkutsk was at that time composed of an infantry regiment of Cossacks, consisting of 2,000 men, and a body of police wearing helmets and blue uniforms laced with silver. Besides, as has been said, in consequence of the events which had occurred, the brother of the Tsar had been shut up in the town since the beginning of the invasion. A journey of political importance had taken the Grand Duke to these distant provinces of Central Asia. After passing through the principal Siberian cities, the Grand Duke, who travelled a militaire rather than en prince, without any parade, accompanied by his officers and escorted by a regiment of Cossacks, arrived in the Transbaikalsin provinces. Nikolaevsk, the last Russian town situated on the shore of the Sea of Okhotsk, had been honoured by a visit from him. Arrived on the confines of the immense Muscovite Empire, the Grand Duke was returning towards Irkutsk, from which place he intended to retake the road to Moscow, when, sudden as a thunderclap, came the news of the invasion. He hastened to the capital, but only reached it just before communication with Russia had been interrupted. There was time to receive only a few telegrams from St. Petersburg and Moscow, and with difficulty to answer them before the wire was cut. Irkutsk was isolated from the rest of the world. The Grand Duke had now only to prepare for resistance, and this he did with that determination and coolness of which, under other circumstances, he had given incontestable proofs. The news of the taking of Ichim, Omsk, and Tomsk successively reached Irkutsk. It was necessary at any price to save the capital of Siberia. Reinforcements could not be expected for some time. The few troops scattered about in the provinces of Siberia could not arrive in sufficiently large numbers to arrest the progress of the Tartar columns. Since, therefore, it was impossible for Irkutsk to escape attack, the most important thing to be done was to put the town in a state to sustain a siege of some duration. The preparations were begun on the day Tomsk fell into the hands of the Tartars. At the same time with this last news, the Grand Duke heard that the Emir of Bokhara and the allied Khans were directing the invasion in person, but what he did not know was that the lieutenant of these barbarous chiefs was Ivan Ogareff, a Russian officer whom he had himself reduced to the ranks, but with whose person he was not acquainted. First of all, as we have seen, the inhabitants of the province of Irkutsk were compelled to abandon the towns and villages. Those who did not take refuge in the capital had to retire beyond Lake Baikal, a district to which the invasion would probably not extend its ravages. The harvests of corn and fodder were collected and stored up in the town, and Irkutsk, the last bulwark of the Muscovite power in the Far East, was put in a condition to resist the enemy for a lengthened period. Irkutsk, founded in 1611, is situated at the confluence of the Irkut and the Angara, on the right bank of the latter river. Two wooden drawbridges, built on piles, connected the town with its suburbs on the left bank. On this side, defense was easy. The suburbs were abandoned, the bridges destroyed. The Angara being here very wide, it would not be possible to pass it under the fire of the besieged. But the river might be crossed both above and below the town, and consequently Irkutsk ran a risk of being attacked on its east side, on which there was no wall to protect it. The whole population were immediately set to work on the fortifications. They labored day and night. The Grand Duke observed with satisfaction the zeal exhibited by the people in the work, whom ere long he would find equally courageous in the defense. Soldiers, merchants, exiles, peasants, all devoted themselves to the common safety. A week before the Tartars appeared on the Angara, earthworks had been raised. A fosse, flooded by the waters of the Angara, was dug between the scarp and counterscarp. The town could not be taken by a coup de main. It must be invested and besieged. The third Tartar column, the one which came up the valley of the Yenisei on the 24th of September, appeared in sight of Irkutsk. It immediately occupied the deserted suburbs, every building in which had been destroyed so as not to impede the fire of the Grand Duke's guns, unfortunately but few in number and of small caliber. The Tartar troops as they arrived organized a camp on the bank of the Angara, whilst waiting the arrival of the two other columns commanded by the Emir and his allies. The junction of these different bodies was effected on the 25th of September in the Angara camp, and the whole of the invading army, except the garrisons left in the principal conquered towns, was concentrated under the command of Feofar Khan. The passage of the Angara in front of Irkutsk having been regarded by Ogareff as impracticable, a strong body of troops crossed, several versts up the river, by means of bridges formed with boats. The Grand Duke did not attempt to oppose the enemy in their passage. He could only impede, not prevent it, having no field artillery at his disposal, and he therefore remained in Irkutsk. The Tartars now occupied the right bank of the river. Then, advancing towards the town, they burnt in passing the summer house of the governor-general, and at last, having entirely invested Irkutsk, took up their positions for the siege. Ivan Ogareff, who was a clever engineer, was perfectly competent to direct a regular siege, but he did not possess the materials for operating rapidly. He was disappointed, too, in the chief object of all his efforts, the surprise of Irkutsk. Things had not turned out as he hoped. First, the march of the Tartar army was delayed by the Battle of Tomsk, and secondly, the preparations for the defense were made far more rapidly than he had supposed possible. These two things had balked his plans. He was now under the necessity of instituting a regular siege of the town. However, by his suggestion, the Emir twice attempted the capture of the place, at the cost of a large sacrifice of men. He threw soldiers on the earthworks which presented any weak point, but these two assaults were repulsed with the greatest courage. The Grand Duke and his officers did not spare themselves on this occasion. They appeared in person. They led the civil population to the ramparts. Citizens and peasants both did their duty. At the second attack, the Tartars managed to force one of the gates. A fight took place at the head of Bolchaya Street, 2 versts long, on the banks of the Angara. But the Cossacks, the police, the citizens, united in so fierce a resistance that the Tartars were driven out. Ivan Ogareff then thought of obtaining by stratagem what he could not gain by force. We have said that his plan was to penetrate into the town, make his way to the Grand Duke, gain his confidence, and, when the time came, give up the gates to the besiegers, and, that done, wreak his vengeance on the brother of the Tsar. The Tsigane Sangar, who had accompanied him to the Angara, urged him to put this plan in execution. Indeed, it was necessary to act without delay. The Russian troops from the government of Yakutsk were advancing towards Irkutsk. They had concentrated along the upper course of the Lena. In 6 days they would arrive. Therefore, before 6 days had passed, Irkutsk must be betrayed. Ogareff hesitated no longer. One evening, the 2nd of October, a council of war was held in the grand saloon of the palace of the governor-general. This palace, standing at the end of Bolchaya Street, overlooked the river. From its windows could be seen the camp of the Tartars, and had the invaders possessed guns of wider range, they would have rendered the palace uninhabitable. The Grand Duke, General Voronzov, the governor of the town, and the chief of the merchants, with several officers, had collected to determine upon various proposals.
"Gentlemen," said the Grand Duke, "you know our situation exactly. I have the firm hope that we shall be able to hold out until the arrival of the Yakutsk troops. We shall then be able to drive off these barbarian hordes, and it will not be my fault if they do not pay dearly for this invasion of the Muscovite territory."
"Your Highness knows that all the population of Irkutsk may be relied on," said General Voronzov.
"Yes, General," replied the Grand Duke, "and I do justice to their patriotism. Thanks to God, they have not yet been subjected to the horrors of epidemic and famine, and I have reason to hope that they will escape them. But I cannot admire their courage on the ramparts enough. You hear my words, Sir Merchant, and I beg you to repeat such to them."
"I thank your Highness in the name of the town," answered the merchant chief. "May I ask you what is the most distant date when we may expect the relieving army?"
6 days at most, sir," replied the Grand Duke. "A brave and clever messenger managed this morning to get into the town, and he told me that 50,000 Russians under General Kiselev are advancing by forced marches. 2 days ago they were on the banks of the Lena at Kerensk, and now neither frost nor snow will keep them back. 50,000 good men, taking the Tartars on the flank, will soon set us free."
"I will add," said the chief of the merchants, "that we shall be ready to execute your orders any day that your Highness may command a sortie."
"Good, sir," replied the Grand Duke. "Wait till the heads of the relieving columns appear on the heights, and we will speedily crush these invaders." Then, turning to General Voronzov, "Tomorrow," said he, "we will visit the works on the right bank. Ice is drifting down the Angara, which will not be long in freezing, and in that case the Tartars might perhaps cross."
"Will your Highness allow me to make an observation?" said the chief of the merchants.
"Do so, sir.
I have more than once seen the temperature fall to 30 and 40 degrees below zero, and the Angara has still carried down drifting ice without entirely freezing. This is, no doubt, owing to the swiftness of its current. If, therefore, the Tartars have no other means of crossing the river, I can assure your Highness that they will not enter Irkutsk in that way."
The governor-general confirmed this assertion. "It is a fortunate circumstance," responded the Grand Duke. "Nevertheless, we must hold ourselves ready for any emergency." He then, turning towards the head of the police, asked, "Have you nothing to say to me, sir?"
"I have, your Highness," answered the head of police, "a petition which is addressed to you through me."
"Addressed by whom?"
"By the Siberian exiles, whom, as your Highness knows, are in the town to the number of 500.
The political exiles, distributed over the province, had been collected in Irkutsk from the beginning of the invasion. They had obeyed the order to rally in the town, and leave the villages where they exercised their different professions, some doctors, some professors, either at the gymnasium or at the Japanese school, or at the school of navigation. The Grand Duke, trusting like the Tsar in their patriotism, had armed them, and they had thoroughly proved their bravery. "What do the exiles ask?" said the Grand Duke.
"They ask the consent of your Highness," answered the head of police, "to their forming a special corps and being placed in the front of the first sortie."
"Yes," replied the Grand Duke, with an emotion which he did not seek to hide,
"these exiles are Russians, and it is their right to fight for their country."
"I believe I may assure your Highness," said the Governor-General, "you will have no better soldiers."
"But they must have a chief," said the Grand Duke. "Who will he be?"
"They wish to recommend to your Highness," said the head of police, "one of their number, who has distinguished himself on several occasions."
"Is he a Russian?"
"Yes, a Russian from the Baltic provinces."
"His name?"
"Is Vasily Fedor."
This exile was Nadia's father. Vasily Fedor, as we have already said, followed his profession of a medical man in Irkutsk. He was clever and charitable, and also possessed the greatest courage and most sincere patriotism. All the time which he did not devote to the sick, he employed in organizing the defense. It was he who had united his companions in exile in the common cause. The exiles, till then mingled with the population, had behaved in such a way as to draw on themselves the attention of the Grand Duke. In several sorties they had paid with their blood their debt to Holy Russia, holy as they believe and adored by her children. Vasily Fedor had behaved heroically, his name had been mentioned several times, but he never asked either thanks or favors, and when the exiles of Irkutsk thought of forming themselves into a special corps, he was ignorant of their intention of choosing him for their captain. When the head of police mentioned this name, the Grand Duke answered that it was not unknown to him.
"Indeed," remarked General Voronzoff, "Vasily Fedor is a man of worth and courage. His influence over his companions has always been very great."
"How long has he been at Irkutsk?" asked the Duke.
"For 2 years."
"And his conduct?"
"His conduct," answered the head of police, "is that of a man obedient to the special laws which govern him."
"General," said the Grand Duke, "General, be good enough to present him to me immediately."
The orders of the Grand Duke were obeyed, and before half an hour had passed, Fedor was introduced into his presence. He was a man over 40, tall, of a stern and sad countenance. One felt that his whole life was summed up in a single word, strife. He had striven and suffered. His features bore a marked resemblance to those of his daughter, Nadia Fedor. This Tartar invasion had severely wounded him in his tenderest affections, and ruined the hope of the father, exiled 8,000 versts from his native town. A letter had apprised him of the death of his wife, and at the same time of the departure of his daughter, who had obtained from the government an authorization to join him at Irkutsk. Nadia must have left Riga on the 10th of July. The invasion had begun on the 15th of July. If at that time Nadia had passed the frontier, what could have become of her in the midst of the invaders? The anxiety of the unhappy father may be supposed when, from that time, he had no further news of his daughter. Vasily Fedor entered the presence of the Grand Duke, bowed, and waited to be questioned.
"Vasily Fedor," said the Grand Duke, "your companions in exile have asked to be allowed to form a select corps. They are not ignorant that in this corps they must make up their minds to be killed to the last man?"
"They are not ignorant of it," replied Fedor. "They wish to have you for their captain."
"I, your Highness?"
"Do you consent to be placed at their head?"
"Yes, if it is for the good of Russia."
"Captain Fedor," said the Grand Duke, "you are no longer an exile."
"Thanks, your Highness, but can I command those who are so still?"
"They are so no longer."
The brother of the Tsar had granted a pardon to all Fedor's companions in exile, now his companions in arms. Vasily Fedor wrung with emotion the hand which the Grand Duke held out to him, and retired. The latter turned to his officers.
"The Tsar will not refuse to ratify that pardon," said he, smiling. "We need heroes to defend the capital of Siberia, and I have just made some."
This pardon, so generously accorded to the exiles of Irkutsk, was indeed an act of real justice and sound policy. It was now night. Through the windows of the palace burned the fires of the Tartar camp, flickering beyond the Angara. Down the river drifted numerous blocks of ice, some of which stuck on the piles of the old bridges, others were swept along by the current with great rapidity. It was evident, as the merchant had observed, that it would be very difficult for the Angara to freeze all over. The defenders of Irkutsk had not to dread being attacked on that side. 10 o'clock had just struck. The Grand Duke was about to dismiss his officers and retire to his apartments when a tumult was heard outside the palace. Almost immediately the door was thrown open, an aide-de-camp appeared, and advanced rapidly towards the Grand Duke. "Your Highness," said he, "a courier from the Tsar." End of Book 2, Chapter 12. Book 2, Chapter 13 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 13. The Tsar's Courier. All the members of the council simultaneously started forward. A courier from the Tsar arrived in Irkutsk. Had these officers for a moment considered the improbability of this fact, they would certainly not have credited what they heard. The Grand Duke advanced quickly to his aide-de-camp. "This courier!" he exclaimed. A man entered. He appeared exhausted with fatigue. He wore the dress of a Siberian peasant, worn into tatters, and exhibiting several shot-holes. A Muscovite cap was on his head. His face was disfigured by a recently healed scar. The man had evidently had a long and painful journey, his shoes being in a state which showed that he had been obliged to make part of it on foot.
"His Highness the Grand Duke?" he asked.
The Grand Duke went up to him. "You are a courier from the Tsar?" he asked.
"Yes, Your Highness."
"You come?"
"From Moscow."
"You left Moscow?"
"On the 15th of July."
"Your name?"
"Michael Strogoff."
It was Ivan Ogareff. He had taken the designation of the man whom he believed that he had rendered powerless. Neither the Grand Duke nor anyone knew him in Irkutsk, and he had not even to disguise his features. As he was in a position to prove his pretended identity, no one could have any reason for doubting him. He came, therefore, sustained by his iron will, to hasten by treason and assassination the great object of the invasion. After Ogareff had replied, the Grand Duke signed to all his officers to withdraw. He and the false Michael Strogoff remained alone in the saloon. The Grand Duke looked at Ivan Ogareff for some moments with extreme attention. Then he said, "On the 15th of July you were at Moscow?"
"Yes, Your Highness, and on the night of the 14th I saw His Majesty the Tsar at the New Palace."
"Have you a letter from the Tsar?"
"Here it is."
And Ivan Ogareff handed to the Grand Duke the imperial letter, crumpled to almost microscopic size.
"Was the letter given you in this state?" "No, Your Highness, but I was obliged to tear the envelope, the better to hide it from the Emir's soldiers."
"Were you taken prisoner by the Tartars?"
"Yes, Your Highness, I was their prisoner for several days," answered Ogareff. "That is the reason that, having left Moscow on the 15th of July, as the date of that letter shows, I only reached Irkutsk on the 2nd of October, after travelling 79 days.
The Grand Duke took the letter. He unfolded it, and recognized the Tsar's signature, preceded by the decisive formula, written by his brother's hand. There was no possible doubt of the authenticity of this letter, nor of the identity of the courier. Though Ogareff's countenance had at first inspired the Grand Duke with some distrust, he let nothing of it appear, and it soon vanished. The Grand Duke remained for a few minutes without speaking. He read the letter slowly, so as to take in its meaning fully. "Michael Strogoff, do you know the contents of this letter?" he asked.
"Yes, Your Highness. I might have been obliged to destroy it to prevent its falling into the hands of the Tartars, and should such have been the case, I wish to be able to bring the contents of it to Your Highness."
"You know that this letter enjoins us all to die rather than give up the town?"
"I know it."
"You know also that it informs me of the movements of the troops which have combined to stop the invasion?"
"Yes, Your Highness, but the movements have failed."
"What do you mean?"
"I mean that Ichim, Omsk, Tomsk, to speak only of the more important towns of the two Siberias, have been successively occupied by the soldiers of Feofar Khan.
But there has been fighting?
Have not our Cossacks met the Tartars? Several times, your highness.
And they were repulsed?
They were not in sufficient force to oppose the enemy.
Where did the encounters take place?
At Kolyvan, at Tomsk.
Until now, Ogareff had only spoken the truth, but in the hope of troubling the defenders of Irkutsk by exaggerating the defeats, he added,
and a third time before Krasnoyarsk.
And what of this last engagement?
Asked the Grand Duke, through whose compressed lips the words could scarcely pass. It was more than an engagement, your highness, answered Ogareff. It was a battle.
A battle?
20,000 Russians from the frontier provinces and the government of Tobolsk engaged with 150,000 Tartars, and notwithstanding their courage were overwhelmed.
You lie!
Exclaimed the Grand Duke, endeavoring in vain to curb his passion. I speak the truth, your highness, replied Ivan Ogareff coldly. I was present at the Battle of Krasnoyarsk, and it was there I was made prisoner.
The Grand Duke grew calmer, and by a significant gesture he gave Ogareff to understand that he did not doubt his veracity.
What day did this Battle of Krasnoyarsk take place? He asked. On the 2nd of September.
And now all the Tartar troops are concentrated here?
All.
And you estimate them?
At about 400,000 men.
Another exaggeration of Ogareff's in the estimate of the Tartar army, with the same object as before.
And I must not expect any help from the West Provinces? Asked the Grand Duke.
None, your highness, at any rate before the end of the winter.
Well, hear this, Michael Strogoff. Though I must expect no help, either from the east or from the west, even were these barbarians 600,000 strong, I will never give up Irkutsk.
Ogareff's evil eye slightly contracted. The traitor thought to himself that the brother of the Tsar did not reckon the result of treason. The Grand Duke, who was of a nervous temperament, had great difficulty in keeping calm whilst hearing this disastrous news. He walked to and fro in the room under the gaze of Ogareff, who eyed him as a victim reserved for vengeance. He stopped at the windows, he looked forth at the fires in the Tartar camp, he listened to the noise of the ice blocks drifting down the Angara. A quarter of an hour passed without his putting any more questions. Then, taking up the letter, he reread a passage and said,
"You know that in this letter I am warned of a traitor, of whom I must beware?"
"Yes, your highness."
"He will try to enter Irkutsk in disguise, gain my confidence, and betray the town to the Tartars."
"I know all that, your highness, and I know also that Ivan Ogareff has sworn to revenge himself personally on the Tsar's brother."
"Why?"
"It is said that the officer in question was condemned by the Grand Duke to a humiliating degradation."
"Yes, I remember. But it is a proof that the villain, who could afterwards serve against his country and head an invasion of barbarians, deserved it."
"His Majesty the Tsar," said Ogareff, "was particularly anxious that you should be warned of the criminal projects of Ivan Ogareff against your person."
"Yes, of that the letter informs me."
"And His Majesty himself spoke to me of it, telling me I was above all things to beware of the traitor."
"Did you meet with him?"
"Yes, your highness, after the Battle of Krasnoyarsk. If he had only guessed that I was the bearer of a letter addressed to your highness, in which his plans were revealed, I should not have got off so easily."
"No, you would have been lost," replied the Grand Duke. "And how did you manage to escape?"
"By throwing myself into the Irtych."
"And how did you enter Irkutsk?"
"Under cover of a sortie, which was made this evening to repulse a Tartar detachment. I mingled with the defenders of the town, made myself known, and was immediately conducted before your highness."
"Good, Michael Strogoff," answered the Grand Duke. "You have shown courage and zeal in your difficult mission. I will not forget you. Have you any favor to ask?"
"None, unless it is to be allowed to fight at the side of your highness," replied Ogareff.
"So be it, Strogoff. I attach you from today to my person, and you shall be lodged in the palace.
And if, according to his intention, Ivan Ogareff should present himself to your highness under a false name,
we will unmask him, thanks to you, who know him, and I will make him die under the knout. Go!"
Ogareff gave a military salute, not forgetting that he was a captain of the couriers of the Tsar, and retired. Ogareff had so far played his unworthy part with success. The Grand Duke's entire confidence had been accorded him. He could now betray it whenever it suited him. He would inhabit the very palace. He would be in the secret of all the operations for the defense of the town. He thus held the situation in his hand, as it were. No one in Irkutsk knew him. No one could snatch off his mask. He resolved, therefore, to set to work without delay. Indeed, time pressed. The town must be captured before the arrival of the Russians from the north and east, and that was only a question of a few days. The Tartars once masters of Irkutsk, it would not be easy to take it again from them. At any rate, even if they were obliged to abandon it later, they would not do so before they had utterly destroyed it, and before the head of the Grand Duke had rolled at the feet of Feofar Khan. Ivan Ogareff, having every facility for seeing, observing, and acting, occupied himself the next day with visiting the ramparts. He was everywhere received with cordial congratulations from officers, soldiers, and citizens. To them this courier from the Tsar was a link which connected them with the Empire. Ogareff recounted, with an assurance which never failed, numerous fictitious events of his journey. Then, with the cunning for which he was noted, without dwelling too much on it at first, he spoke of the gravity of the situation, exaggerating the success of the Tartars and the numbers of the barbarian forces, as he had when speaking to the Grand Duke. According to him, the expected succors would be insufficient, if ever they arrived at all, and it was to be feared that a battle fought under the walls of Irkutsk would be as fatal as the battles of Kolyvan, Tomsk, and Krasnoyarsk. Ogareff was not too free in these insinuations. He wished to allow them to sink gradually into the minds of the defenders of Irkutsk. He pretended only to answer with reluctance when much pressed with questions. He always added that they must fight to the last man and blow up the town rather than yield. These false statements would have done more harm had it been possible, but the garrison and the population of Irkutsk were too patriotic to let themselves be moved. Of all the soldiers and citizens shut up in this town, isolated at the extremity of the Asiatic world, not one dreamed of even speaking of a capitulation. The contempt of the Russians for these barbarians was boundless. No one suspected the odious part played by Ivan Ogareff. No one guessed that the pretended courier of the Tsar was a traitor. It occurred very naturally that on his arrival at Irkutsk, a frequent intercourse was established between Ogareff and one of the bravest defenders of the town, Vasily Fedor. We know what anxiety this unhappy father suffered. If his daughter, Nadia Fedor, had left Russia on the date fixed by the last letter he had received from Riga, what had become of her? Was she still trying to cross the invaded provinces, or had she long since been taken prisoner? The only alleviation to Vasily Fedor's anxiety was when he could obtain an opportunity of engaging in battle with the Tartars, opportunities which came too seldom for his taste. The very evening the pretended courier arrived, Vasily Fedor went to the governor-general's palace and, acquainting Ogareff with the circumstances under which his daughter must have left European Russia, told him all his uneasiness about her. Ogareff did not know Nadia, although he had met her in Ichim on the day she was there with Michael Strogoff, but then he had not paid more attention to her than to the two reporters, who at the same time were in the post-house. He therefore could give Vasily Fedor no news of his daughter.
"But at what time," asked Ogareff, "must your daughter have left the Russian territory?"
"About the same time that you did," replied Fedor.
"I left Moscow on the 15th of July.
Nadia must also have quitted Moscow at that time. Her letter told me so expressly."
"She was in Moscow on the 15th of July?"
"Yes, certainly by that date."
"Then it was impossible for her—" "But no, I am mistaken. I was confusing dates. Unfortunately, it is too probable that your daughter must have passed the frontier, and you can only have one hope, that she stopped on learning the news of the Tartar invasion."
The father's head fell. He knew Nadia, and he knew too well that nothing would have prevented her from setting out. Ivan Ogareff had just committed gratuitously an act of real cruelty. With a word he might have reassured Fedor. Although Nadia had passed the frontier under circumstances with which we are acquainted, Fedor, by comparing the date on which his daughter would have been at Nizhny Novgorod and the date of the proclamation which forbade anyone to leave it, would no doubt have concluded thus, that Nadia had not been exposed to the dangers of the invasion, and that she was still, in spite of herself, in the European territory of the Empire. Ogareff, obedient to his nature, a man who was never touched by the sufferings of others, might have said that word. He did not say it. Fedor retired with his heart broken. In that interview, his last hope was crushed. During the two following days, the 3rd and 4th of October, the Grand Duke often spoke to the pretended Michael Strogoff, and made him repeat all that he had heard in the Imperial Cabinet of the New Palace. Ogareff, prepared for all these questions, replied without the least hesitation. He intentionally did not conceal that the Tsar's government had been utterly surprised by the invasion, that the insurrection had been prepared in the greatest possible secrecy, that the Tartars were already masters of the line of the Obi when the news reached Moscow, and, lastly, that none of the necessary preparations were completed in the Russian provinces for sending into Siberia the troops requisite for repulsing the invaders. Ivan Ogareff, being entirely free in his movements, began to study Irkutsk, the state of its fortifications, their weak points, so as to profit subsequently by his observations, in the event of being prevented from consummating his act of treason. He examined particularly the Bolchaya Gate, the one he wished to deliver up. Twice in the evening he came upon the glacis of this gate. He walked up and down without fear of being discovered by the besiegers, whose nearest posts were at least a mile from the ramparts. He fancied that he was recognized by no one, till he caught sight of a shadow gliding along outside the earthworks. Sangarre had come at the risk of her life for the purpose of putting herself in communication with Ivan Ogareff. For 2 days the besieged had enjoyed a tranquillity to which the Tartars had not accustomed them since the commencement of the investment. This was by Ogareff's orders. Feofar Khan's lieutenant wished that all attempts to take the town by force should be suspended. He hoped the watchfulness of the besieged would relax. At any rate, several thousand Tartars were kept in readiness at the outposts to attack the gate deserted, as Ogareff anticipated that it would be, by its defenders, whenever he should summon the besiegers to the assault. This he could not now delay in doing. All must be over by the time that the Russian troops should come in sight of Irkutsk. Ogareff's arrangements were made, and on this evening a note fell from the top of the earthworks into Sangarre's hands. On the next day, that is to say, during the hours of darkness from the 5th to the 6th of October, at 2 o'clock in the morning, Ivan Ogareff had resolved to deliver up Irkutsk. End of Book 2, Chapter 13. Book 2, Chapter 14 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 14. The Night of the 5th of October. Ivan Ogareff's plan had been contrived with the greatest care, and except for some unforeseen accident, he believed that it must succeed. It was of importance that the Bolchaya Gate should be unguarded or only feebly held when he gave it up. The attention of the besieged was therefore to be drawn to another part of the town. A diversion was agreed upon with the Emir. This diversion was to be effected both up and down the river on the Irkutsk bank. The attack on these two points was to be conducted in earnest, and at the same time a feigned attempt at crossing the Angara from the left bank was to be made. The Bolchaya Gate would probably be deserted, so much the more because on this side the Tartar outposts, having drawn back, would appear to have broken up. It was the 5th of October. In 24 hours, the capital of Eastern Siberia would be in the hands of the Emir, and the Grand Duke in the power of Ivan Ogareff. During the day, an unusual stir was going on in the Angara camp. From the windows of the palace, important preparations on the opposite shore could be distinctly seen. Numerous Tartar detachments were converging towards the camp, and from hour to hour reinforced the Emir's troops. These movements, intended to deceive the besieged, were conducted in the most open manner possible before their eyes. Ogareff had warned the Grand Duke that an attack was to be feared. He knew, he said, that an assault was to be made, both above and below the town, and he counseled the Duke to reinforce the two directly threatened points. Accordingly, after a council of war had been held in the palace, orders were issued to concentrate the defense on the bank of the Angara and at the two ends of the town, where the earthworks protected the river. This was exactly what Ogareff wished. He did not expect that the Bolchaya Gate would be left entirely without defenders, but that there would only be a small number. Besides, Ogareff meant to give such importance to the diversion that the Grand Duke would be obliged to oppose it with all his available forces. The traitor planned also to produce so frightful a catastrophe that terror must inevitably overwhelm the hearts of the besieged. All day the garrison and population of Irkutsk were on the alert. The measures to repel an attack on the points hitherto unassailed had been taken. The Grand Duke and General Voranzov visited the posts, strengthened by their orders. Vasily Fedor's corps occupied the north of the town, but with orders to throw themselves where the danger was greatest. The right bank of the Angara had been protected with the few guns possessed by the defenders. With these measures, taken in time, thanks to the advice so opportunely given by Ivan Ogareff, there was good reason to hope that the expected attack would be repulsed. In that case the Tartars, momentarily discouraged, would no doubt not make another attempt against the town for several days. Now the troops expected by the Grand Duke might arrive at any hour. The safety or the loss of Irkutsk hung only by a thread. On this day the sun, which had risen at 6:20, set at 5:40, having traced its diurnal arc for 11 hours above the horizon. The twilight would struggle with the night for another 2 hours. Then it would be intensely dark, for the sky was cloudy, and there would be no moon. This gloom would favor the plans of Ivan Ogareff. For a few days already a sharp frost had given warning of the approaching rigor of the Siberian winter, and this evening it was especially severe. The Russians posted by the bank of the Angara, obliged to conceal their position, lighted no fires. They suffered cruelly from the low temperature. A few feet below them, the ice in large masses drifted down the current. All day these masses had been seen passing rapidly between the two banks. This had been considered by the Grand Duke and his officers as fortunate. Should the channel of the Angara continue to be thus obstructed, the passage must be impracticable. The Tartars could use neither rafts nor boats. As to their crossing the river on the ice, that was not possible. The newly frozen plain could not bear the weight of an assaulting column. This circumstance, as it appeared favorable to the defenders of Irkutsk, Ogareff might have regretted. He did not do so, however. The traitor knew well that the Tartars would not try to pass the Angara, and that, on its side at least, their attempt was only a feint. About 10 in the evening the state of the river sensibly improved, to the great surprise of the besieged and still more to their disadvantage. The passage till then impracticable became all at once possible. The bed of the Angara was clear. The blocks of ice, which had for some days drifted past in large numbers, disappeared down the current, and 5 or 6 only now occupied the space between the banks. The Russian officers reported this change in the river to the Grand Duke. They suggested that it was probably caused by the circumstance that in some narrower part of the Angara the blocks had accumulated so as to form a barrier. We know this was the case. The passage of the Angara was thus open to the besiegers. There was great reason for the Russians to be on their guard. Up to midnight nothing had occurred. On the eastern side, beyond the Bolchaya Gate, all was quiet. Not a glimmer was seen in the dense forest, which appeared confounded on the horizon with the masses of clouds hanging low down in the sky. Lights, flitting to and fro in the Angara camp, showed that a considerable movement was taking place. From a verst above and below the point where the scarp met the river's bank came a dull murmur, proving that the Tartars were on foot, expecting some signal. An hour passed. Nothing new. The bell of the Irkutsk Cathedral was about to strike 2 o'clock in the morning, and not a movement amongst the besiegers had yet shown that they were about to commence the assault. The Grand Duke and his officers began to suspect that they had been mistaken. Had it really been the Tartars' plan to surprise the town? The preceding nights had not been nearly so quiet. Musketry rattling from the outposts, shells whistling through the air, and this time nothing. The officers waited, ready to give their orders according to circumstances. We have said that Ogareff occupied a room in the palace. It was a large chamber on the ground floor, its windows opening on a side terrace. By taking a few steps along this terrace, a view of the river could be obtained. Profound darkness reigned in the room. Ogareff stood by a window, awaiting the hour to act. The signal, of course, would come from him alone. This signal once given, when the greater part of the defenders of Irkutsk would be summoned to the points openly attacked, his plan was to leave the palace and hurry to the Bolchaya Gate. If it was unguarded, he would open it, or at least he would direct the overwhelming mass of its assailants against the few defenders. He now crouched in the shadow like a wild beast ready to spring on its prey. A few minutes before 2 o'clock, the Grand Duke desired that Michael Strogoff, which was the only name they could give to Ivan Ogareff, should be brought to him. An aide-de-camp came to the room, the door of which was closed. He called. Ogareff, motionless near the window, and invisible in the shade, did not answer. The Grand Duke was therefore informed that the Tsar's courier was not at that moment in the palace. 2 o'clock struck. Now was the time to cause the diversion agreed upon with the Tartars waiting for the assault. Ivan Ogareff opened the window and stationed himself at the north angle of the side terrace. Below him flowed the roaring waters of the Angara. Ogareff took a match from his pocket, struck it, and lighted a small bunch of tow, impregnated with priming powder, which he threw into the river. It was by the orders of Ivan Ogareff that the torrents of mineral oil had been thrown on the surface of the Angara. There are numerous naphtha springs above Irkutsk, on the right bank, between the suburb of Poshkavsk and the town. Ogareff had resolved to employ this terrible means to carry fire into Irkutsk. He therefore took possession of the immense reservoirs which contained the combustible liquid. It was only necessary to demolish a piece of wall in order to allow it to flow out in a vast stream. This had been done that night, a few hours previously, and this was the reason that the raft which carried the true courier of the Tsar, Nadia, and the fugitives, floated on a current of mineral oil. Through the breaches in these reservoirs of enormous dimensions rushed the naphtha in torrents, and following the inclination of the ground, it spread over the surface of the river, where its density allowed it to float. This was the way Ivan Ogareff carried on warfare. Allied with Tartars, he acted like a Tartar, and against his own countrymen. The tow had been thrown on the waters of the Angara. In an instant, with electrical rapidity, as if the current had been of alcohol, the whole river was in a blaze above and below the town. Columns of blue flames ran between the two banks. Volumes of vapor curled up above. The few pieces of ice which still drifted were seized by the burning liquid and melted like wax on the top of a furnace, the evaporated water escaping in shrill hisses. At the same moment, firing broke out on the north and south of the town. The enemy's batteries discharged their guns at random. Several thousand Tartars rushed to the assault of the earthworks. The houses on the bank, built of wood, took fire in every direction. A bright light dissipated the darkness of the night. "At last," said Ivan Ogareff. He had good reason for congratulating himself. The diversion which he had planned was terrible. The defenders of Irkutsk found themselves between the attack of the Tartars and the fearful effects of fire. The bells rang, and all the able-bodied of the population ran, some towards the points attacked, and others towards the houses in the grasp of the flames, which it seemed too probable would ere long envelop the whole town. The gate of Bolchaya was nearly free. Only a very small guard had been left there. And by the traitor's suggestion, and in order that the event might be explained apart from him, as if by political hate, this small guard had been chosen from the little band of exiles. Ogareff re-entered his room, now brilliantly lighted by the flames from the Angara. Then he made ready to go. But scarcely had he opened the door when a woman rushed into the room, her clothes drenched, her hair in disorder. "Sangar!" exclaimed Ogareff in the first moment of surprise, and not supposing that it could be any other woman than the gypsy. It was not Sangar. It was Nadia. At the moment when, floating on the ice, the girl had uttered a cry on seeing the fire spreading along the current, Michael had seized her in his arms and plunged with her into the river itself to seek a refuge in its depths from the flames. The block which bore them was not 30 fathoms from the first quay of Irkutsk. Swimming beneath the water, Michael managed to get a footing with Nadia on the quay. Michael Strogoff had reached his journey's end. He was in Irkutsk.
"To the governor's palace," said he to Nadia.
In less than 10 minutes they arrived at the entrance to the palace. Long tongues of flame from the Angara licked its walls, but were powerless to set it on fire. Beyond, the houses on the bank were in a blaze. The palace being open to all, Michael and Nadia entered without difficulty. In the confusion, no one remarked them, although their garments were dripping. A crowd of officers coming for orders, and of soldiers running to execute them, filled the great hall on the ground floor. There, in a sudden eddy of the confused multitude, Michael and the young girl were separated from each other. Nadia ran distracted through the passages, calling her companion, and asking to be taken to the Grand Duke. A door into a room flooded with light opened before her. She entered, and found herself suddenly face to face with the man whom she had met at Ichim, whom she had seen at Tomsk, face to face with the one whose villainous hand would an instant later betray the town.
"Ivan Ogareff!" she cried.
On hearing his name pronounced, the wretch started. His real name known, all his plans would be balked. There was but one thing to be done, to kill the person who had just uttered it. Ogareff darted at Nadia, but the girl, a knife in her hand, retreated against the wall, determined to defend herself.
"Ivan Ogareff!"
again cried Nadia, knowing well that so detested a name would soon bring her help.
"Ah, be silent!"
hissed out the traitor between his clenched teeth.
"Ivan Ogareff!"
exclaimed a third time the brave young girl, in a voice to which hate had added tenfold strength. Mad with fury, Ogareff, drawing a dagger from his belt, again rushed at Nadia and compelled her to retreat into a corner of the room. Her last hope appeared gone, when the villain, suddenly lifted by an irresistible force, was dashed to the ground.
"Michael!"
cried Nadia. It was Michael Strogoff. Michael had heard Nadia's call. Guided by her voice, he had just in time reached Ivan Ogareff's room and entered by the open door.
"Fear nothing, Nadia,"
said he, placing himself between her and Ogareff.
"Ah," cried the girl, "take care, brother. The traitor is armed. He can see."
Ogareff rose, and thinking that he had an immeasurable advantage over the blind man, leaped upon him. But with one hand the blind man grasped the arm of his enemy, seized his weapon, and hurled him again to the ground. Pale with rage and shame, Ogareff remembered that he wore a sword. He drew it and returned a second time to the charge. A blind man! Ogareff had only to deal with a blind man. He was more than a match for him. Nadia, terrified at the danger which threatened her companion, ran to the door calling for help.
"Close the door, Nadia," said Michael. "Call no one, and leave me alone. The Tsar's courier has nothing to fear today from this villain. Let him come on if he dares. I am ready for him."
In the meantime, Ogareff, gathering himself together like a tiger about to spring, uttered not a word. The noise of his footsteps, his very breathing, he endeavored to conceal from the ear of the blind man. His object was to strike before his opponent was aware of his approach, to strike him with a deadly blow. Nadia, terrified and at the same time confident, watched this terrible scene with involuntary admiration. Michael's calm bearing seemed to have inspired her. Michael's sole weapon was his Siberian knife. He did not see his adversary armed with a sword, it is true, but heaven's support seemed to be afforded him. How, almost without stirring, did he always face the point of the sword? Ivan Ogareff watched his strange adversary with visible anxiety. His superhuman calm had an effect upon him. In vain, appealing to his reason, did he tell himself that in so unequal a combat all the advantages were on his side. The immobility of the blind man froze him. He had settled on the place where he would strike his victim. He had fixed upon it. What, then, hindered him from putting an end to his blind antagonist? At last, with a spring, he drove his sword full at Michael's breast. An imperceptible movement of the blind man's knife turned aside the blow. Michael had not been touched, and coolly he awaited a second attack. Cold drops stood on Ogareff's brow. He drew back a step, then again leaped forward. But as had the first, this second attempt failed. The knife had simply parried the blow from the traitor's useless sword. Mad with rage and terror before this living statue, he gazed into the wide open eyes of the blind man, those eyes which seemed to pierce to the bottom of his soul, and yet which did not, could not, see, exercised a sort of dreadful fascination over him. All at once, Ogareff uttered a cry. A sudden light flashed across his brain.
"He sees!" he exclaimed. "He sees!"
And like a wild beast trying to retreat into its den, step by step, terrified, he drew back to the end of the room. Then the statue became animated. The blind man walked straight up to Ivan Ogareff, and placing himself right before him,
"Yes, I see," said he. "I see the mark of the knout which I gave you, traitor and coward. I see the place where I am about to strike you. Defend your life. It is a duel I deign to offer you, my knife against your sword."
"He sees," said Nadia. "Gracious heaven, is it possible?"
Ogareff felt that he was lost, but mustering all his courage, he sprang forward on his impassible adversary. The two blades crossed, but at a touch from Michael's knife, wielded in the hand of the Siberian hunter, the sword flew in splinters, and the wretch, stabbed to the heart, fell lifeless on the ground. At the same moment, the door was thrown open. The Grand Duke, accompanied by some of his officers, appeared on the threshold. The Grand Duke advanced. In the body lying on the ground, he recognized the man whom he believed to be the Tsar's courier. Then, in a threatening voice, "Who killed that man?" he asked.
"I," replied Michael.
One of the officers put a pistol to his temple, ready to fire.
"Your name?" asked the Grand Duke, before giving the order for his brains to be blown out. "Your Highness," answered Michael, "ask me rather the name of the man who lies at your feet." "That man, I know him. He is a servant of my brother. He is the Tsar's courier." "That man, your Highness, is not a courier of the Tsar. He is Ivan Ogareff."
"Ivan Ogareff!" exclaimed the Grand Duke.
"Yes, Ivan the traitor."
"But who are you then?"
"Michael Strogoff."
End of Book 2, Chapter 14. Book 2, Chapter 15 of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar. This LibriVox recording is in the public domain. Michael Strogoff by Jules Verne. Book 2, Chapter 15. Conclusion. Michael Strogoff was not, had never been, blind. A purely human phenomenon, at the same time moral and physical, had neutralized the action of the incandescent blade which Feofar's executioner had passed before his eyes. It may be remembered that at the moment of the execution, Marfa Strogoff was present, stretching out her hands towards her son. Michael gazed at her as a son would gaze at his mother when it is for the last time. The tears, which his pride in vain endeavored to subdue, welling up from his heart, gathered under his eyelids, and volatilizing on the cornea, had saved his sight. The vapor formed by his tears interposing between the glowing saber and his eyeballs had been sufficient to annihilate the action of the heat. A similar effect is produced when a workman's smelter, after dipping his hand in vapor, can with impunity hold it over a stream of melted iron. Michael had immediately understood the danger in which he would be placed should he make known his secret to anyone. He at once saw, on the other hand, that he might make use of his supposed blindness for the accomplishment of his designs. Because it was believed that he was blind, he would be allowed to go free. He must therefore be blind, blind to all, even to Nadia, blind everywhere, and not a gesture at any moment must let the truth be suspected. His resolution was taken. He must risk his life, even to afford to all he might meet, the proof of his want of sight. We know how perfectly he acted the part he had determined on. His mother alone knew the truth, and he had whispered it to her in Tomsk itself, when bending over her in the dark he covered her with kisses. When Ogareff had in his cruel irony held the imperial letter before the eyes which he believed were destroyed, Michael had been able to read, and had read the letter which disclosed the odious plans of the traitor. This was the reason of the wonderful resolution he exhibited during the second part of his journey. This was the reason of his unalterable longing to reach Irkutsk, so as to perform his mission by word of mouth. He knew that the town would be betrayed. He knew that the life of the Grand Duke was threatened. The safety of the Tsar's brother and of Siberia was in his hands. This story was told in a few words to the Grand Duke, and Michael repeated also, and with what emotion, the part Nadia had taken in these events. "Who is this girl?" asked the Grand Duke. "The daughter of the exile, Vasily Fedor," replied Michael. "The daughter of Captain Fedor," said the Grand Duke, "has ceased to be the daughter of an exile. There are no longer exiles in Irkutsk." Nadia, less strong in joy than she had been in grief, fell on her knees before the Grand Duke, who raised her with one hand, while he extended the other to Michael. An hour after, Nadia was in her father's arms. Michael Strogoff, Nadia, and Vasily Fedor were united. This was the height of happiness to them all. The Tartars had been repulsed in their double attack on the town. Vasily Fedor, with his little band, had driven back the first assailants who presented themselves at the Bolchaya gate, expecting to find it open, and which, by an instinctive feeling, often arising from sound judgment, he had determined to remain at and defend. At the same time as the Tartars were driven back, the besieged had mastered the fire. The liquid naphtha having rapidly burnt to the surface of the water, the flames did not go beyond the houses on the shore, and left the other quarters of the town uninjured. Before daybreak, the troops of Feofar Khan had retreated into their camp, leaving a large number of dead on and below the ramparts. Among the dead was the gypsy Sangar, who had vainly endeavored to join Ivan Ogareff. For 2 days the besiegers attempted no fresh assault. They were discouraged by the death of Ogareff. This man was the mainspring of the invasion, and he alone, by his plots long since contrived, had had sufficient influence over the Khans and their hordes to bring them to the conquest of Asiatic Russia. However, the defenders of Irkutsk kept on their guard, and the investment still continued. But on the 7th of October, at daybreak, cannon boomed out from the heights around Irkutsk. It was the succoring army under the command of General Kiselev, and it was thus that he made known his welcome arrival to the Grand Duke. The Tartars did not wait to be attacked. Not daring to run the risk of a battle under the walls of Irkutsk, they immediately broke up the Angara camp. Irkutsk was at last relieved. With the first Russian soldiers, two of Michael's friends entered the city. They were the inseparable Blount and Jolivet. On gaining the right bank of the Angara by means of the icy barrier, they had escaped, as had the other fugitives, before the flames had reached their raft. This had been noted by Alcide Jolivet in his book in this way: "Ran a narrow chance of being finished up like a lemon in a bowl of punch." Their joy was great on finding Nadia and Michael safe and sound, above all when they learnt that their brave companion was not blind. Harry Blount inscribed this observation: "Red-hot iron is insufficient in some cases to destroy the sensibility of the optic nerve." Then the two correspondents, settled for a time in Irkutsk, busied themselves in putting the notes and impressions of their journey in order. Thence were sent to London and Paris two interesting articles relative to the Tartar invasion, and which, a rare thing, did not contradict each other even on the least important points. The remainder of the campaign was unfortunate to the Emir and his allies. This invasion, futile as all which attacked the Russian colossus must be, was very fatal to them. They soon found themselves cut off by the Tsar's troops, who retook in succession all the conquered towns. Besides this, the winter was terrible, and, decimated by the cold, only a small part of these hordes returned to the steppes of Tartary. The Irkutsk road, by way of the Ural Mountains, was now open. The Grand Duke was anxious to return to Moscow, but he delayed his journey to be present at a touching ceremony, which took place a few days after the entry of the Russian troops. Michael Strogoff sought Nadia, and in her father's presence said to her, "Nadia, my sister still, when you left Riga to come to Irkutsk, did you leave it with any other regret than that for your mother?" "No," replied Nadia, "none of any sort whatever."
"Then nothing of your heart remains there?"
"Nothing, brother."
"Then, Nadia," said Michael, "I think that God, in allowing us to meet, and to go through so many severe trials together, must have meant us to be united forever."
"Ah!" said Nadia, falling into Michael's arms. Then turning towards Vasily Fedor, "My father," said she, blushing.
"Nadia," said Captain Fedor, "it will be my joy to call you both my children." The marriage ceremony took place in Irkutsk Cathedral.
Jolivet and Blount very naturally assisted at this marriage, of which they wished to give an account to their readers.
"And doesn't it make you wish to imitate them?" asked Alcide of his friend.
"Pooh," said Blount, "now if I had a cousin like you..." "My cousin isn't to be married," answered Alcide, laughing.
"So much the better," returned Blount, "for they speak of difficulties arising between London and Peking. Have you no wish to go and see what is going on there?"
"By Jove, my dear Blount," exclaimed Alcide Jolivet, "I was just going to make the same proposal to you."
And that was how the two inseparables set off for China. A few days after the ceremony, Michael and Nadia Strogoff, accompanied by Vasily Fedor, took the route to Europe. The road so full of suffering when going was a road of joy in returning. They traveled swiftly in one of those sleighs which glide like an express train across the frozen steppes of Siberia. However, when they reached the banks of the Dinka, just before Bursko, they stopped for a while. Michael found the place where he had buried poor Nicholas. A cross was erected there, and Nadia prayed a last time on the grave of the humble and heroic friend whom neither of them would ever forget. At Omsk, old Marfa awaited them in the little house of the Strogoffs. She clasped passionately in her arms the girl whom in her heart she had already 100 times called daughter. The brave old Siberian, on that day, had the right to recognize her son and say she was proud of him. After a few days passed at Omsk, Michael and Nadia entered Europe, and Vasily Fedor settling down in St. Petersburg, neither his son nor his daughter had any occasion to leave him, except to go and see their old mother. The young courier was received by the Tsar, who attached him specially to his own person, and gave him the cross of St. George. In the course of time, Michael Strogoff reached a high station in the empire. But it is not the history of his success, but the history of his trials, which deserves to be related. End of Book 2, Chapter 15. End of Michael Strogoff, Courier of the Tsar, by Jules Verne.
Find all your 4th of July needs at low prices, all in the Kroger app. Get USDA Choice Bone-In Tender Ribeye Steaks for $7.99 a pound with a digital coupon. Limit 5, then buy 2, get 3 free on 12 packs of delicious Coca-Cola, Pepsi, or 7-Up. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.